Please open your Bibles again to Psalm 99. Psalm 99. That's on page 500 of the Church Bibles. Two things before we properly plunge into the psalm. The first of them is this. Maybe you noticed it, but perhaps cast your eyes down the psalm now. I want you to note how the vertical and the horizontal are seamlessly interwoven. Verse 3, let them praise your great and awesome name. There's the vertical. Holy is he. There's the horizontal. That's to other singers or whoever's listening. Verses 4 and 5. The king in his might loves justice. Now that looks horizontal. It may be vertical, but it looks horizontal. All right. But notice, you have established equity. There's the vertical again. It continues. You have executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. Now the horizontal, again, to other singers or to those who are listening. Exalt the Lord our God, worship at his footstool, holy is he. Jumping to verses 8 and 9. O Lord our God, you answered them. You were a forgiving God to them. And literally the Hebrew apparently is, you were to them God who forgives, in the form of a name, all right? God who forgives, that's what the Hebrew literally says, all right? Our ESVs have adapted that. You were a forgiving God to them. Rather, you were to them God who forgives. We'll come back to that. But an avenger of their wrongdoings, all of that's vertical. But then look at verse 9. Exalt the Lord our God and worship at his holy mountain, for the Lord our God is holy. Again, that's all horizontal, all right? Now, that's not unique. Psalm 99 is just a glorious example of the vertical and the horizontal seamlessly interwoven. We see this repeatedly in the Psalms. Why? Well, song worship isn't just vertical. It's horizontal too, as we rehearse the Lord's glories to each other, as we celebrate his greatness in his presence and in his hearing. He is here, right? As we call on others to join us in the worship of the one and only true God. Yes, you who haven't embraced God as God, we're calling on you too to join us, right? Who haven't believed in Jesus. Now, when we sing horizontally, as it were, that's not less than praise. It's not less than praise. It's what we could call enriched uranium. It's enriched praise, all right? It is enriched praise. Now, the South Africans are going to laugh here. In black South African culture, there's a character called the Imbongi. The Imbongi is the praise singer. The Imbongi is the praise singer. His or her duty is to praise important people, mostly VIPs. We can all get cynical and skeptical now, but that's not the point, all right? The duty of the Imbongi is to praise important people, VIPs, at important events or functions in the hearing of all. It's a long time ago that Nelson Mandela was installed as president of South Africa, but something happened at that event that hadn't happened before. There was an Imbongi, a praise singer, singing the praise, as it were, of Nelson Mandela, all right? And in singing the praises of the great and the good, the Imbongi switches, often unpredictably, from second person you, that's that VIP, right, to the third person, he or she, in their hearing. And Psalm 99 is doing exactly the same thing. We are all wired to acknowledge greatness. we are all wired to do that communally, together, and to do it both vertically, you, and horizontally, he or she. Indeed, there's something missing if the vertical doesn't spill over into the horizontal. I hope you are with me. What we value, we speak of and sing of to each other in the hearing of the ones we value. All right. This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Even the Father does it. The second thing to note before we plunge into the psalm is the structure, and then connected to that, the subject matter of the psalm. The structure and the subject matter. Now, there are four parts to the psalm, each focusing on a different thing. Now, the first two parts in our ESVs, in the New King James, they've actually separated them. In the ESV, the first two parts are concatenated, they're joined. The third part, 6 and 7, fourth part, 8 and 9. Parts 1 and 2, 1 through 5. All right? That in the ESV, I think they've probably joined them at the hip because there's a connection there between parts 1 and 2 that you can't get rid of. But for the moment, all right, we'll get back to this. Verses 1 to 3 focus on the Lord's sovereignty. This is the one who reigns. The Lord reigns. Verses 1 to 3 focus on the Lord's sovereignty. Verses 4 and 5 focus on the Lord's justice. Verses 6 and 7 focus on the Lord's engagement with his people, or with people more generally, all right, the Lord's engagement with people. And then verses 8 and 9 focus on the Lord's forgiveness. Sovereignty, justice, engagement, forgiveness. Now, we'll get back to those four themes. For the moment, three of the parts, the first two parts and the fourth, the last part, they each end with an assertion. And what is that assertion? That assertion is that the Lord is holy. The first and the second parts end identically. They simply say, holy is he. End of verse 3, end of verse 5, holy is he. But when we move down to the fourth and the last part, we read the words, all right, the last line in verse 9, for the Lord our God is holy. Is holiness, is the Lord's holiness perhaps the overarching theme, the wrapping paper, as it were, all right, for the entire psalm? Yes, there's no mention of holiness, no mention of the Lord's holiness in the third part of the psalm. And I personally can't find an explanation for that. Maybe you can. But irrespective of whether we can find an explanation for the absence of any mention or explicit assertion of the Lord's holiness in the third part of the psalm, the holiness of the Lord would still appear to be that central organizing theme. So what is the psalmist getting at when he says that God is holy? Well, the word holy, and most of us know this, but maybe not all, the word holy means one of two things. Often it means both. First of all, the holy, that which is holy, is pure and perfect. Pure and perfect. Totally and utterly unpolluted. Nothing missing. It's also complete. There's no gaps. No imperfections, no deficiencies, complete. But secondly, the holy is also different. We could say separate, different, because it's of a different kind. It's set apart. It's separate. It's of another kind. It's incomparable. Indeed, given the world we live in, the holy is otherworldly. Holiness is that excellence that shines with the light of another world. Now you put those two meanings together, the pure and the holy and the different. Put the two together and you have the pure, the perfect, and the different, the incomparably and transcendentally pure, perfect, and different. And that's God. There is only one of Him. And the one of Him that exists is incomparably and transcendentally pure, perfect, and different. He's not just the best of a great bunch. He is His own kind, and He is of a kind that knows no competitor. And I think this is probably the way that the psalmist is using the word holy, right? Both meanings are probably in view. We could say that the Lord's holiness, at least in Psalm 99, is the sum total of His transcendent excellence. Holiness isn't another quality added onto the Lord's sovereignty, the Lord's justice, the Lord's interaction and engagement with sinners. And then finally, just another thing added alongside the Lord's forgiveness. That the manner in which God possesses and exercises and engages in all of those things, and the fact that He possesses and exercises all those things in an incomparably pure, perfect, and different way, that demands the conclusion, holy is He. Isaiah saw. Isaiah heard. Seraphim. Oh, how to see seraphim. All right? Isaiah saw and he heard seraphim crying to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." Psalm 99 makes exactly the same point. Coincidentally, perhaps, three times. The issue is this: the Lord is holy. He is holy in a multiplicative sense. He is holy repletively. And Psalm 99 just simply celebrates four elements. It celebrates four elements of the Lord's transcendent excellence. In other words, the overarching theme of Psalm 99 is this: the Lord is uniquely complete and perfect, and He is that in four ways. First of all, sovereignty. First of all, sovereignty. Verses 1 through 3. The Lord reigns. Let the peoples tremble. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim. Let the earth quake. The Lord is great in Zion. He is exalted over all the peoples. Let them praise Your great and awesome name. And then we have the first assertion, holy is He. Now I want you to notice four aspects to the Lord's incomparable and transcendent sovereignty. We'll rip through these quite quickly. The first is power and authority. Power and authority. Another lovely word is regal prerogative. Prerogative? Kings and queens have, at least ancient ones do. We have constitutional monarchs now, but in the past, kings and queens had prerogative, royal prerogative. The Lord reigns. And the Lord possesses power and authority with punch. people and earth-shaking punch. Still in verse 1, let the peoples tremble. Skipping a line, let the earth quake. So the first thing to note is the power, the authority, the royal prerogative that the Lord possesses. The second aspect to the Lord's incomparable and transcendent sovereignty is exaltation. Exaltation. The line we skipped in verse 1, he sits enthroned upon the cherubim, and then jumping to the second part of verse 2, he is exalted over all the peoples. Moving on, the third aspect to the Lord's incomparable and transcendent sovereignty is adoration and love. Adoration and love. What is a sovereign? What is a king without a people who adore and love him? Nothing. Verse 2, the Lord is great. Where? In Zion. The Lord is great in Zion. To his people. What is Zion? Zion is the collection of the redeemed, right? And to his people, the Lord is great. The fourth and the last aspect to the Lord's incomparable and transcendent sovereignty, his holy sovereignty, is right. Right. Right to the acknowledgement and the adoration of all peoples. The second half of verse 2 again, and then the first half of verse 3. He is exalted over, not just Zion, all the peoples. Let them praise your great and awesome name. And they will, won't they? At the name of Jesus, every knee will bow. So the Lord is holy in his sovereignty. Secondly, the Lord is holy in his justice. Verses 4 and 5. The king in his might loves justice. You have established equity. You have executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. Exalt the Lord our God. Worship at his footstool. Holy is he. Now again, we're going to notice a number of things, three things in this instance. The first and the third a little bit longer than the second. First of all, I want you to notice that the Lord's justice isn't a check or a balance on the Lord's might. The Lord's justice isn't a check or a control or a balance on the Lord's might. Here's a king whose might does not need controlling because, and this is the first part of verse 4, the king in his might loves justice. I think this is the reason why verses 1 through 3 and 4 and 5 are joined at the hip, because we've got sovereignty flowing into our second quality, virtue, perfection, justice. All right, notice how these words, the king in his might loves justice. These words explicitly connect the second theme with the previous, which was the first theme. The Lord in his sovereignty loves justice. In other words, the first thing to note concerning the Lord's justice is actually a fifth feature of his sovereignty. The Lord's sovereignty is just, and not accidentally or by compulsion. The king in his might loves justice. You see, there's no tension between God's attributes. They love each other. We need to separate powers on the face of the earth. Why? Because men and women cannot be trusted. Modern democracy has its roots in Christianity. Not only, obviously, because the Greeks practiced this, practiced it, and others closer to hand. The Irish in the Dark Ages, believe it or not, a form of democracy. All right? Why the separation of powers in Western democracies? It's because of human depravity. Human depravity. We need to separate powers on the face of the earth because men and women cannot be trusted. In God, might and justice, sovereignty and justice, they work in tandem, perfectly in tandem. You see, the truth is not might is right. The truth is might loves justice. The second thing to note concerning the second section on justice is that God isn't subject to a law outside of himself. He is the origin of law. The second part of verse 4, and this is all I'm going to say, you have established equity. God is the law. No human being can say that. No created reality can say that. Then thirdly, God doesn't just talk about justice, he actually executes it. He practices it. It's not just a value he has signed up to. He walks the talk, as we say, particularly amongst his own people. Look at the last part of verse 4. You have executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. This doesn't mean that there's no justice beyond the Lord's people, beyond Jacob. It simply states that there is justice among the Lord's people. Those he loves, he disciplines. Judgment starts with the people of God, right? Those he loves, he disciplines. And he does, doesn't he? But the issue is this. The Lord is worthy of worship for his sovereignty. He's also worthy of worship for his justice. Verse 5, exalt the Lord our God, worship at his footstool. What's going on here? Footstool. Well, we won't turn there. Listen to me. This is Isaiah 66 and verse 1. And the Lord says, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. In other words, the earth is nothing but a footstool for its creator. A humble, albeit a glorious part in the grand and the total scheme of things. We need to think bigger, brothers and sisters, friends. The world is not everything that is. There is a reality as great as God is great. All right? But I suspect it's not so much a place. All right? Heaven in his throne is his throne and earth is his footstool. Don't focus on the word footstool so much as the posture that it speaks of. The psalmist is essentially saying, and each of us who sing the psalm and sing it to each other, we're basically saying, bow at his feet. No better feet to bow to. We gladly do, don't we? At least those of us who are captives of his grace. And it's not demeaning, it is rehumanizing. All right, thirdly, God is holy in his engagement with people. God is holy in his engagement with people. He is not so high as to have nothing to do with mere creatures. Verse 6 onwards, Moses and Aaron were among his priests. Samuel also was among those who called upon his name. They called to the Lord and he answered them. In the pillar of the cloud, he spoke to them. They kept his testimonies and the statute that he gave them. Now, notice two things here. First of all, I want you to notice the two-way nature of believing life before the Lord. Perhaps I'm going to sneak in one just before that. Notice the initiative. It starts with Moses and Aaron were among his priests. Not self-appointed. All right? Not self-appointed. But really, the first thing to notice is the two-way nature of believing life before the Lord. When he is called upon, what does he do? He answers. How? He rescues. The pillar of the cloud speaks of a rescue, the great Exodus, right? He rescues, and then he speaks. In the pillar of cloud, he spoke to them. It wasn't silent. And what do God's people, the Lord who reigns, his people, his true people do in response? Well, they do his will, his revealed will, what he has said. They kept his testimonies and the statute that he gave them. Now, I can't leave this alone. It was too tempting for me. I want you to notice how verses 6 and 7 beautifully answer the question that the reformers wrestled with in the 16th century. All right? Where is the true church found? Where is the true church found? And for any unbelieving friends here, where is the true church of God and Christ? Well, it's found in three ways. All right. It's found where the Lord is called upon, sincerely, all right, where the Lord is called upon. Secondly, it's found where he is present in his word, not a fiery cloud, but this book now, all right, in his word. He's present nowhere else, at least not graciously and savingly. But then thirdly, all right, he's present where that same word, signaling the Lord's presence, okay, is welcomed and also kept. Where a true work of grace is done, the law is there obeyed, and those who previously were bad show from sin they've been saved. Their instruments of war and hate are hammered into plows. Instead of uttering angry words, they make religious vows. Now, the second thing under the Lord's engagement with sinful creatures is this. The second thing worth noticing is this. The naming of Moses and Aaron and Samuel, all of them were priests, all right? Also prophets, all right? At least in the case of Moses and Samuel, all right? But it reminds us of the need for mediation in the Lord's engagement with sinners. He is holy, the polluted. Can't come into his presence. There's no communion with the Lord without some form of mediation. We cannot call upon him in our own right. Simon Doyle cannot call upon the Lord in my own right, his own right. Someone needs to stand in between, okay? And in this regard, just very briefly, Moses and Aaron and Samuel, they simply prefigured. They simply anticipated as tiny little and imperfect and often unholy pictures. All right. They pictured the one and only mediator between God and man. And who is it? It is the God-man, the one who reigns, all right? The God-man, Jesus Christ. So we've looked at sovereignty, we've looked at justice, we've looked at the Lord's engagement, this holy God. Fourthly and lastly, God is holy in his forgiveness. Are you noting a progression here? I hope you are. We'll get back to this progression later. Fourthly, the last part. God is holy in his forgiveness. Verse 8. Just verse 8 for the moment. O Lord our God, you answered them. You were a forgiving God to them, but an avenger of their wrongdoings. If parts 1 and 2 are connected, sovereignty and justice, parts 3 and 4 are also connected. All right, the sovereignty of part 1 flows into part 2 in terms of the might of sovereignty loving justice, and then the engagement and the interaction, indeed the initiative shown in part 3, it flows into part 4 in terms of the Lord's answering needy sinners at their greatest point of need. Our greatest point of need is not food and clothing. It's not a career and a future on this earth. It's forgiveness. And that's actually the first of three things to note in this fourth and last part. First of all, God answers sinners at their greatest point of need, and that's forgiveness. Again, the first two parts of verse 8, O Lord our God, you answered them, you were a forgiving God to them. I've already said this, the Hebrew apparently says, I don't know Hebrew, I rely on the experts. Literally it says, you were to them God who forgives, hyphenated. God hyphen who hyphen forgives. You see, God doesn't just happen to be a forgiving God. He can be called that. His very identity is inseparably tied up with forgiveness. So much so that he can be called God who forgives. Allah cannot be guaranteed to be merciful. We're told because that would undermine his sovereignty. The God of Roman Catholicism, and I hope I'm not insulting anybody, but the God of Roman Catholicism, whoever he is, offers no assurance. No assurance. But the only true sovereign, the God who reigns, Jehovah Malak, he forgives, and he forgives predictably in such a way as he can be called God who forgives. Whosoever calls on the name of the Lord shall, not might, shall be saved. That, however, shouldn't breed complacence. Secondly now, and it needs to be said, the second thing to note verses in this last part, all right, more particularly the end of verse 8. This needs to be said. Those who play fast and loose with the God who forgives find they are actually playing fast and loose with the God of sovereign justice. And we could turn that into a name as well. God hyphen of hyphen sovereign hyphen justice. Verse 8 again, O Lord our God, you answered them, you were a forgiving God to them, but an avenger, that's a strong word, an avenger of their wrongdoings. Now here's the third thing, because there's an alternative way to look at the last part of verse 8. What's being said appears odd, doesn't it? All right? Well, second and third parts of verse 8. You were a forgiving God to them, forgiving, but an avenger of their wrongdoings. Forgiving, but an avenger. Is it perhaps deliberately odd sounding? Is it said in such a way like those, is it 991 or 999 in this country? People might speak in code, and those folk on those operators, they know how to hear something and what's being said when it can't necessarily be said. All right? Is this perhaps what's happening at the third part of verse 8? All right? I think it's designed, but this is speculative exposition, all right? All right? I think it's designed to make us not just hear that those who play fast and loose with the forgiving, the God who forgives, actually encounter the God of sovereign justice. I think it's saying perhaps something else, all right? Is there a nuanced allusion to atonement in this third and last line of verse 8? Let me cast it in my own words. You were to them a forgiving God, God who forgives, though not without having to deal with what their deeds deserved. You following me? In other words, he forgave, but the forgiveness didn't come free. That's always true. The Lord is the God who forgives, but not by ignoring sin. He doesn't sweep it under the carpet. Sin must be dealt with, and it is dealt with. The sin of his people is dealt with. It's dealt with by Christ in his death. Pictured when the psalm was first sung in the bloody sacrifice of countless substitutionary victims. And so the third thing to note about verse 8 at the very least, is that the Lord's forgiveness doesn't come cheap. It has to be avenged. Now, the reason why I'm opting or suggesting this third possible take on the end of verse 8 is because the word avenge is very strong for simple discipline. Right? All right? Yes, Israel was a mixed bunch. And there was a need to repeatedly clean that bunch out. Let's just end this point on this point. Our wrongdoings cannot be simply swept under the carpet. They have to be avenged. And in those who have embraced Jesus Christ as Savior, they were dealt with at the cross, paid for completely. Now it's time to tie things up. All right, verse 9 is part and parcel of the fourth and the last part of the psalm. It also ties the whole psalm up. You will notice that it's almost identical to the end of the first and second parts. All right, what is its point? There literally is no one or anything like him. Also, all right, in addition, it's not just that there is no one or anything like him. Also, and precisely because of who he is, there is no one more worthy of worship. Exalt our God, or rather exalt the Lord our God, and worship at his holy mountain. All right? Zion, Jerusalem with the temple on the mount, right, in the Old Testament. What is the holy mountain now? It's the church of Jesus Christ across the face of the earth. And worship at his holy mountain, for the Lord our God is holy. The history of the human race is a history of misplaced faith and misdirected attention. That's people trusting in the untrustable and giving themselves to the unworthy again and again and again. We're all seeking for the holy in some way or other. We're all seeking for the pure and the untainted, also the different, something out of this world. The only ones who find that are those who find Christ. Christ, that's God's promised king. He is the complete king. And we come back to this issue of progression in the psalm. Please notice it. He's absolutely sovereign. And then he is righteous and just to boot. But he is not remote. He takes the initiative and he engages with fallen mankind. More importantly, he forgives. And not by sweeping sin and evil and guilt and pollution under the carpet. But notice how might melts into magnanimity towards rebels. And nothing of the might is lost in that. None of the Lord's greatness. In fact, that's why he is great, right? With the Lord there is forgiveness, therefore he is feared. And that's why we call on others. Bow the knee to the King who is worthy.